right, well, let's continue in our study, our sermon series on the book of Psalms, like our summer playlist. I want to invite you to join me in Psalm 126, which you can find on page 912 in the Bibles under your seats. Now, today's psalm was requested by one of you. It is also part two of like a little two-part mini-series of sorts within our larger series on the book of Psalms. Now, last week in part one, we looked at Psalm 137, which is definitely the most troubling psalm in the book of Psalms, if not one of the most troubling passages in the entire Bible. That's because Psalm 137 not only laments all the things that were lost when Israel was taken into captivity in Babylon, Psalm 137 also calls for vengeance, like eye for an eye retribution against the people of Babylon. Now, if you missed that sermon and you want to catch up on it, you can find it on our website. But today we're going to turn our attention to Psalm 126, which celebrates a reorientation, if you will. It celebrates a reversal of all those things that were lost, the things that are lamented in Psalm 137. At the end of the day, what Psalm 126 celebrates is Israel's return home from exile. Now, the thing about Psalm 126 is it is also part of kind of a mini series of psalms within the book of Psalms. It's part of a collection of psalms known as the Psalms of Ascent. The Psalms of Ascent are found in Psalm 120 through Psalm 134, and these are a collection of songs that pilgrims would have sung on their way up to Jerusalem for the big three annual feasts of Tabernacles, Passover, and Pentecost. Now, it's unclear if these songs were written distinctly for this purpose or if they were simply collected later. But whatever the case, these are the road trip songs. This is the playlist of things that pilgrims would sing when they were going up to celebrate this. Now, if you're wondering why they're called Psalms of Ascent, it's the same reason that I keep talking about people going up to Jerusalem. That's because Jerusalem sits atop of Mount Moriah, which is also sometimes referred to as Mount Zion. Zion is the theological thing that became associated with it. That's because Zion is the Hebrew word for refuge. Now, Mount Moriah is not the highest point in Israel, but it is the holiest point. That's because Mount Moriah / Mount Zion, this is where Abraham and Isaac were tested in Genesis 22. This is where Israel's temple was built and rebuilt. This is where God said his people were to gather forever to celebrate his promises, or at least until those promises were fulfilled in Jesus. But we're not going to get ahead of ourselves just yet. Let's stick with these promises, which we find in places like Psalm 126, which I'm going to invite you to join me in reading now. When the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dreamed. Our mouths were filled with laughter, our tongues with songs of joy. Then it was said among the nations, "The Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us, and we are filled with joy." Restore our fortunes, Lord, like streams in the Negev. Those who sow with tears will reap with songs of joy. Those who go out weeping, carrying seed to sow, will return with songs of joy, carrying sheaves with them. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. All right, I don't know about you, but I am really glad to hear some joy and celebration in the psalm, especially after last week's psalm with all of that kind of retribution and anger. But this is exactly why we're looking at these psalms together. Like Psalm 137 says, how can we sing the songs of Zion in a foreign land? Well, Psalm 126 then says, when the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dreamed. Our mouths were filled with laughter and our tongues with songs of joy. Now, there is a ton packed into these statements of reversal. But the thing is it is most likely difficult, if not impossible, for us to comprehend the magnitude of what is being said here. like we ourselves would have to have endured some long seasons, some decades of captivity to appreciate the joy with which Jews who were heading up to Jerusalem would have declared this song after spending 70 years in captivity in Babylon. Or perhaps after 70 years of hearing their parents and grandparents drone on and on about how hard it was for them growing up. Anybody ever grow up with anyone who was like, your parents or grandparents ever tell you stories about, you know, we had to walk to school both ways, uphill, in the snow, and all those kind of things? I heard some stories like that. This is not one of those stories. This is a story that is more like slaves hearing about their liberation on June the 19th. Or like the descendants of slaves celebrating that deliverance on Juneteenth. Like life as people knew it seemed to be over. And then God shows up to the rescue. He restores his people's fortunes. Now, so you know, the word fortune in verse 1 is not about financial gain. That word actually means return, which, yes, you can get a return on your investment, but this is talking about a return home. This is about a homecoming that filled people with laughter, or more literally, that led to outbursts of joy and celebration, which actually makes the nations around Israel stop and take note. Did you catch this remarkable line in verse 2? Then it was said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The thing is I don't know how literally we should take that statement, but I do hope that we can appreciate it theologically, because this is how God works in our world. Theology is, it's the study of God and the way he works. And the way God works in the world is he blesses his people for the world to see. Beyond that, God blesses his people so that his people might bless the world. Now that said, we're going to think about this statement literally just for a moment. Imagine the nations around Israel seeing the people of Israel gather in Jerusalem to celebrate. Jerusalem, which had been obliterated by the Babylonian Empire when it conquered Israel, or what was left of it in a place called Judah, way back in 597 BC. Like Jerusalem was a pile of rubble. It was nothing when the Jews returned home in 538 BC. And even though the Jewish people rebuilt the city, and they rebuilt the temple, which is pretty significant, that temple was, let's just say, a bit disappointing. It was a mere shadow of the former glory that Israel had associated with the temple. And we know this because a man named Ezra says in the book that he wrote that this dedication of this second temple was, I don't know, a bit complicated. He says, all the people gave a great shout of praise to the Lord because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. But many of the older priests and Levites and family heads who had seen the former temple wept aloud when they saw the foundation of this temple being laid, while many others shouted for joy. No one could distinguish the sound of the shouts of joy from the sound of weeping because the people made so much noise. And the sound was heard far away. Can you imagine Israel's neighbors kind of catching wind of what's going on here? Can you imagine them being like, why are you celebrating? What are you celebrating? I mean, your home is in ruins, and all your home improvement projects, they clearly are disappointing. And beyond that, sure, Babylon is gone, but now Persia rules over you. Psalm 126 paints an interesting, if not ironic, picture when it says that the nations marvel at God's goodness to his people. And yet, there is something marvelous going on here. Now, that said, if you pay attention, it does seem like the feeling of this marvel, that is, the joy that surrounds this return home, it seems like that may be starting to feel like a thing of the past. Like, did you notice the past tense verbs in this psalm? We were like those who dreamed. Our mouths were filled with joy. In other words, this psalm does seem to recall the great joy that God's people experienced when they first got set free. But that joy starts to feel a bit muted midway through the psalm. I mean, even this great reversal, this idea of restoration and reorientation, it very much sounds like a work in progress. I mean, verse 1 says, hey, the Lord restored our fortunes. But look at verse 4. Restore our fortunes, Lord. It seems like all the excitement is dissipated. Or maybe to quote that great theologian, B.B. King, the thrill is gone. Right? Now, there's still some joy to be found in heading up to Jerusalem. I mean, that's something you couldn't do in exile in Babylon. Again, as Psalm 137 so horribly illustrates for us. But as much as there was joy in being able to do that, can you imagine how that joy might begin to subside and dissipate with each passing year? Maybe even with each passing empire. I mean, because the thing is, yes, the Persians came in and took place of Babylon and they set Israel free. But things weren't all that great. And even after Greece took the place of the Persians, the Greeks did some horrible things, horrific things to the people of Israel. And yes, thankfully, Rome, I say ironically, thankfully Rome came in and got rid of Greece, but Rome didn't oppress them quite as overtly, and yet Rome still ruled over this land that God said he alone would rule over. Now, which empire ruled over Israel when this psalm was written is a bit unclear. And at the end of the day, it's a bit irrelevant because this song was sung in all these empires. It was sung again and again. And it's actually even still sung today, even though some things changed way back in 70 AD when Rome literally wiped Israel off the face of the map. Now, if you want to hear more about that, again, I will refer you to last week's sermon. But for now, simply know, simply pay attention to the fact that Israel's cries for restoration of joy at the present accompanies its recollection of this joy of the past. And it does so via a couple of pictures, which are really important for us to consider. And the first of which is actually found in verse 4, where it says, "Restore our fortunes, Lord, like streams in the Negev." Now, the Negev is the desert region in the southern part of Israel. And I mean desert with a capital D. Like, I've been to the Negev, and I can testify to the fact that it is hot. The weather here has nothing to, nothing to compare to this. It is hot, it is dry, and if you don't have tons of water, it can be deadly. And I know this because our guides drilled this into our head. In fact, we had to wear belts with all these water bottles on them, like a Batman utility belt. And in case we ran out, our guides had like double the belts with extra water just so that no one got sued. Now, the thing is I was in the Negev in 2022. A.D. When this psalm was written, which would have been sometime after 538 B.C., there were no tour guides in the Negev. There was no one there to bail you out if you ran out of water. The only water that you had is what you brought in with you and maybe what you hoped. But that's what Psalm 126 is getting at when it talks about streams in the Negev. Like this place that is arid, that is bone dry for most of the year, when God does send rains, these little ravines called wadis begin to fill up, these fast-moving streams which can become a source of life in the midst of a place that could easily lead to death. The picture here is of God providing instant relief. I mean, these things fill up fast. In fact, you got to get out of them and you'll get swept away by these rushing streams. But the picture here is that of instant relief, instant provision from God, which is contrasted via a second picture, and it's that of harvest, which isn't so instant. Right? Maybe if you've planted things or if you grew up on a farm or something, you know that like a harvest takes a bit more time. You have to sow and water and then wait and wait and wait. That's why this second picture is important. We find it in verses 5 and 6 when it says, those who sow with tears will reap with songs of joy. Those who go out weeping, carrying seed to sow, will return with songs of joy, carrying sheaves with them. Now, the second picture is important because it reminds us that there will be times when we will have to wait for God to provide, and those times of waiting might be accompanied by tears. Now, this picture, combined with the other one, gives us the full picture of the way that God actually blesses and provides for us, which sometimes, yes, comes in an instant. There is immediate relief, immediate rescue. But other times, it's not so instant. It comes after seasons of waiting and praying and watching and weeping. Now, I don't know about you, but I prefer the former to the latter. Actually, I know you. You prefer it as well. Like, right? We all want instant relief, understandably so. This isn't up to us, is it? It's up to God. Of course, the good news that we find about God is that he not only promises to provide for his people, but he actually does provide for us. And this is the story of through and through. From the very beginning, God provides for his people. He provided a ram for Abraham to sacrifice instead of his son Isaac here on Mount Moriah. He provided liberation for his people who were enslaved in Egypt, by the way, after 400 years of waiting. He provided daily food and something to drink in the desert every day for 40 years. Of course, God also provided a home for God's people to call their own. It would come to be known as Israel, or aka Zion, a place of refuge. Then again, God provided wake-up calls when his people went the ways of the nations around them, in prophet after prophet, and then finally through a season of exile in Babylon. Of course, the good news is God ultimately provided a homecoming from exile, which this psalm celebrates. Of course, as we've just said, Psalm 126 seems to hint that there are some diminishing returns on this joy that is found in this homecoming. Like the joy that people once erupted with now seems to subside a bit. Which on the one hand is normal. I mean, like, this is the way that life goes, right? Perhaps you've experienced this, right? There are ups and there are downs. Highs and lows. Joys and seasons of sorrow. On the other hand, this might actually be by design. What I mean is, as great as Israel's homecoming was, it was never meant to fully satisfy. It could never satisfy what our souls cry out for. And no matter how good it was to get home, and no matter how great Israel's temple eventually became. So, you know, that little paltry temple that Ezra talked about, a guy named Herod the Great spent a fortune restoring. By the way, Herod the Great is the father of that kind of crazy Herod that you read about in the Bible. His father was also a bit crazy. He was also fabulously wealthy, and he spent a fortune restoring Israel's temple. It became a showpiece in the ancient world. In fact, it became a marvel. Like, people still do not know how they moved some of these massive stones in place. They have no idea where some of these stones even came from. It just, like, it blows your mind. Like, what happened? And this far exceeds the original temple. But as great as it was to return home, and as great as that temple eventually became, it couldn't satisfy. It never provided the real lasting joy that people were longing for. It's because it was never designed to do that. And it's why I hinted at God's provision in Jesus way back at the beginning of this sermon. Of course, the book of Hebrews doesn't mess around with hints. It just comes out and says it. Hebrews 13 says, for here we do not have an enduring city, but we are looking for the city that is to come. Through Jesus, therefore, let us continually offer to God a sacrifice of praise, the fruit of lips that openly profess his name. What Hebrews is reminding us of is, as good as God's blessings are in this life, there is a greater blessing to come. There is is a better home that we long for. The place that Jesus has gone to prepare for us. There's a home that he has opened the door to by way of his life, death, and resurrection. We're waiting for that. And as we do, we are still offering up sacrifices of praise, as Hebrews 13 says. We're still singing songs like Psalm 126, which doubles as a song of celebration and is a plea for God to show up again, to restore our fortunes, to deliver on those promises that have yet to be fully fulfilled. As long as we live in two time zones, that is between what is and what's to come, this is the way life is going to be. It is going to be full of ups and downs. It is going to be full of highs and lows. We are going to experience joy and sorrow and everything in between. Here's the good news. God not only provides for his people in the gift of his son, Jesus, God also provides for his people in the gift of his Spirit, who Jesus said would come to dwell in us when he left to prepare a place for us. And the Spirit who dwells in us, who dwells in you, bears fruit. That means alongside of all the other things that exist in the human heart, anger and anxiety, fear and despair, everything else that we see expressed in the Psalms, these things exist. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Notice that fruit is singular, not plural. Do you know what that means? It means if the Spirit dwells in you, you have all of this in you. Not just some of it. You don't get to pick and choose fruit like you're at the supermarket. All of this is there. Even when you don't see it. Even maybe when you can't sense it. Even when you don't feel it. This is why the Apostle Paul could write an entire book with a theme of joy. He would write that book called Philippians from prison. From death row, literally. It's why the spirituals that antebellum slaves sang in the South are full of such vibrancy and joy and celebration, even though these songs were written and sung under some of the most horrific conditions. It's why this famous song that maybe you've heard of called Ode to Joy is such a popular and surprising tune. I'm assuming you've heard of Ludwig van Beethoven, right? He's no B.B. King, but he's a pretty decent musician, right? Kidding, of course. This guy's a musical genius. Thing is about Beethoven is his genius got a bit muted midway through his life. That's because he started going deaf, started losing his hearing at the age of 28. And by the time he was 44, he was completely deaf. Which is interesting because it was sometime after he turned 44 when he went completely deaf that he wrote his famous Ninth Symphony, which includes that beloved song, Ode to Joy. Which means it's pretty remarkable that he would write a song like that given what had just happened to him. It's remarkable that he would write or compose an entire symphony that he never heard a note of. Of course, what's remarkable to me is the story of what happened when he first conducted the symphony. On the day of its debut, they actually got a second conductor to be with him because Beethoven couldn't hear anything and they were a little scared it was going to go wrong, so they had somebody else conducting with him. But in addition to not being able to hear anything, Beethoven conducted with his back to the audience as he faced the musicians, which means he really couldn't see anything either. Which is why when this masterpiece of a symphony finished, the audience erupted in applause, in incredible celebration, but Beethoven had no idea what was going on. He couldn't see anything, and he couldn't hear anything, and in fact, he just kept conducting. Someone actually had to turn him around to see the crowd for him to actually join the celebration. I think that's how the Spirit of God works. The Spirit who fills the world with good things, things that are to be celebrated, joy and celebration. The Spirit who fills us with good things, including joy, which we sometimes don't sense or maybe see. But every now and then, the Spirit turns us around and we catch a glimpse of what God is doing in the world. Friends, that's my prayer for you today. It's our prayer, my prayer for us, that the Spirit of God might turn us around to see what He is doing in the world and even in us. That God might reorient our hearts around the good news, which we've celebrated in song and in prayer, which we'll soon celebrate at this table. That Jesus, who lived and died and who lives again, might assure us of His presence. That He might fill us with hopes like streams in the desert. And that He might assure us of His promises. That even that which is sown with tears in this life will reap a harvest of joy in the life to come. Jesus said, "I'm going away to prepare a place for you. But I'm not leaving you alone. I'm sending the Comforter, the Counselor, the Spirit to be with you. And I'll come back for you. And when I do, I'll take you to where I am." Friends, that is the good news. The true homecoming that awaits those who trust in Christ.